Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, put away your phones now for about the next 30 minutes or so, right? And we're going to get a slow down and do something old school. So I'm delighted now to be joined by the world-renowned Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
And you've chosen some pieces of music for us that have meant something to you at different points in your life. And we often start by asking people about at home growing up. Was there a lot of music in the house?
You know, most of the music in the house came from radio and television. We didn't have a record player, for example, for some reason. Not quite sure why. We did have a piano for a while, as my mother, I suppose, in particular, tried to encourage. There were three kids. Tried to encourage the three of us to get musical, and we each took piano lessons and each kind of serially failed on the piano. So she ended up, I think the piano was probably on HP, higher purchase, if anyone still knows what that means. So actually what she did, funnily enough, was to, I never quite understood it, was to buy a tape recorder. An old Philips tape recorder.
We're kind of reel to reel at that stage.
Very small reels. I guess they were, I don't know, they were very small reels. And it was probably going at probably 7.5 inches per second, something like that. But one of the things that happened was that many of the neighbours, who were, many of whom were musical, wrote songs, in fact, and of course recited poems and so, and sang songs, would come in, and somehow we were in the business of recording the neighbours. We were kind of mini RTE.
Or the Folklore Commission.
Or the Folklore Commission. And, you know, I think people really enjoyed coming to our house. It wasn't exactly a Cayley house, but it was along those lines. So the neighbours came in, they would sing a song, they were recorded, they would listen to themselves. And I suppose it feeds...
Would they listen back straight away after the recording,
They did.
Because the innocence of it.
Yeah. Well, it was innocent. You know, this was an era when there wasn't, you know, when we had a telephone number with three digits in the number, you know. And honestly, I mean, while we had radio and television, television gradually coming in, of course, and making an impact, a lot of it was make your own entertainment.
And your first choice today is Sarah Makeham, as I roved out. Tell us about that.
You know, Sarah Makeham was one of the great singers. She would have been recorded, indeed, by people who were
Did Alan Lomax?
I think he did. Yeah,
absolutely.
There were various people who would have recorded her. I mean, she was an extraordinary singer. And in fact, later on, and I often wonder if there's a connection between the old tape recorder in the house and the fact that I eventually started working in radio myself, and I worked for the BBC, and I actually went on a trip to record Sarah Makeham. I was very familiar, of course, as many would be, with her son, Tommy Makeham, and in fact there were Makehams who went to the school I attended in Armagh. But Sarah Makeham, you know, is, I suppose, the genuine article. And this, I suppose, is one of my favourite songs. It's got a little bit of a nonsense element, which is always good too. I'm not sure if we'll get to it. But it's Sarah Makeham, As I Roved Out.
Okay, here we go.
As I roved out on a May morning right early, I met my love upon the way, oh Lord, but she was early. And she sang lil-ta-doodle, lil-ta-doodle, lil-ta-doodle-dee, and she had landed-dee, and she had landed-dee, and she landed. Her boots was black and her stockings white, and her buckles shone like silver. She had a dark and a rolling eye, and her earrings tipped her shoulder. And she sung lil-ta-doodle, lil-ta-doodle, lil-ta-doodle-dee, and she had landed-dee, and she had landed-dee, and she landed.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And like, you can hear Scotland, you can hear Appalachia, we're talking about Alan Lomax, you can, it's all in there, isn't it?
It is. And in fact, I have a theory that her influence, you know, extended perhaps even to the likes of Bob Dylan. You know, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem were big influences on Dylan. They really helped him a lot very early on. And, you know, that just that phrase, as I roved out, and even things like I was thinking of Boots of Spanish Leather along the way there. You know, it's a big, it is an influence on Dylan. And the particular, the little, not in this song so much, but the tagline that it occurs in so many folk songs that you get in the likes of set Tangled Up in Blue, where this phrase recurs at the end of each verse and means something slightly different each time. So anyway, okay. I think her influence is mighty.
Yeah, brilliant. Come here, when did you realise you were a poet?
You know, I suppose I'd hoped that I might be a poet when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
It seemed like a wonderful thing to be attempting to do. I don't know if I've ever quite accepted that I am a poet. I know that may seem like a very strange thing to say. But, and particularly the more I've done it, I realise, first of all, how hard it is.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're a teenager, you're up for anything at all. You're ready for bottle or draft, as they say.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the more I realise it, the more I think that one of the reasons I've continued to do it is, frankly, in the hope, which is now diminishing slightly, that one of these days I'm going to write a really good poem. And I think that's what drives me in many ways, you know?
Yeah, you get the perfect one.
Yeah.
So listen, your next choice brings us into your teens, and it's the Beatles. So you'd obviously grown up in a folky environment and the folk revival was going on. And then what was it like when the Beatles and the Stones and all that kind of kicked off?
Well, I mean, as I think it was Pete Townsend who said, I think, who was he talking about? It might have been Jimi Hendrix. You know, it was like being hit by a truck. I think this was I had kind of eased myself into it, as we all did, including these new artists, you know, through the 1950s with Skiffle and then with the various, the Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly. It was a gradual thing. It wasn't exactly an overnight phenomenon.
American 45s kind of, yeah.
Totally. As I say, we weren't playing them as 45s. We didn't have the equipment, though some of our neighbours did. It was a radio.
Yeah.
It was a radio phenomenon. But the Beatles, and at school, of course, people would be bringing the new Beatles album and the new Stones album to school and playing it. So we were hooked on that.
Yeah. And you've chosen a Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby. Why this one in particular?
You know, there are so many one could choose. And in this case, for what it's worth, which is not necessarily all that much, this is one of those songs that really stands up on the page. It doesn't have to stand up on the page. All it has to do is when it has that extraordinary music with it, that's what makes it. What it most might be is a phrase I find very useful. But on the page it stands up. It's an excellent piece of writing by Lennon and McCartney. And, you know, it's like a little film script. And it reminds me again, as I'm often reminded, of how much of a visual medium, in fact, songwriting is. One sees one thing, one sees another thing. So this is a film script, I'd say, you know?
Okay, this is Paul Muldoon, second choice, The Beatles and Eleanor Rigby.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Church and was buried along with
That's Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles, and that's Paul Muldoon's second choice. And you're right, there's a film there, isn't it? It paints a whole scene and a whole life. And then, of course, you got to become close to Paul McCartney and work with him later in your life.
Well, I did work with him, and I'm not sure how close, a little close perhaps, but I worked with him for 5 years.
You had to kind of develop some kind of dynamic then, did you?
Like, I think we did. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to say too much about it, but, I think one of the reasons we got on quite well, I'd say, and we should just give the context, maybe this was for a book called The Lyrics, where we took 154, as it turns out, of his lyrics written by him. And over the course of 5 years, I interviewed him, met with him, I think about 25 times it was, and we discussed the background to these lyrics. So that, for example, even the kind of stabbing violin there, mm-hmm. in that song, we came to associate with Bernard Herrmann, who was the guy who did the music for Psycho, for example.
Okay, yeah.
Another what would one say, view of a lonely man and a very lonely woman. Or things like the finding out that initially Father McKenzie was actually Father McCartney. But of course they had to change that because that was dead. And how they changed it, which was to get out the yellow pages and start hawking about through those. So, but it was a fascinating experience.
And the reason you got on, you were going to say?
I think the reason we got on was, well, first of all, he's a bit older than I am, but our experience was very similar. I mentioned radio earlier on, and it's important to remember, particularly since we're on the wireless, the radio had a huge impact on the Beatles. The comedy shows, the theatre, the drama shows, radio drama, very, very important to them. The Goons, all of this really played into what they were doing. Sound effects,
yeah,
if you think of
yeah.
the number of sound effects they use. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. But anyway, we had a very similar, what would one say? We were culturally literate in a similar way.
Okay.
The same movies.
Same hinterland.
Same movies, exactly. Same movies, the same same music, and so much else. And also, I think he knew that I wasn't after anything from him except for really an insight into how these songs were made. And we were both very much at the service of these songs.
Yeah.
And so I think that was part of it, I think.
So you've made those conversations now into a podcast, is that right?
Well, actually, that's a complete surprise to me and probably probably to him, in fact, because there was no way when we were recording, we had a couple of microphones placed rather casually, I think we would have to say, on a table. I don't even know if we were favouring him. And that was with a view to a transcript, which we would use in the book, which was transcribed and then I edited it down. But somehow it transpired that at least some of this material was usable, particularly nowadays, when the technology exists to enhance, I suppose, some of it, which was a little ropey, frankly, and probably still is a little ropey. So we were extremely unbuttoned, I think, so much so that I think it's one of the things that people like about the podcast, that it is quite, relaxed.
Yeah.
And what's the paradox there is that had we known that one day it would be heard by somebody other than a transcriber, I think we would have had a very different way of doing it. Probably not
okay.
as interesting.
Okay, so we're eavesdropping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your next song is Leonard Cohen. And I'm delighted you're here and everything, but I do love to meet someone who knew Leonard Cohen, because obviously, like, everyone's, what was he like?
I don't want this to sound like a kind of parade of the great and the good, but I think it's fair to say that, I have been extremely lucky in my life in many, many ways. And one of them has been to get to meet some of these extraordinary artists. Mm-hmm. And Leonard Cohen was certainly that. I mean, we would have started listening to Leonard Cohen early on. And I remember at university kind of listening to songs from a room one time after another. It didn't get the record didn't get a chance to cool.
Yeah.
So I mean, he again is a writer who is who's collected poems, for example. That volume, his collected poems are indistinguishable from his collected songs. So again, the pressure per square inch, to use a phrase I find useful.
Very good, yeah.
In it's not necessary. It's not necessary that the pressure per square inch be as high in a song as it is in a poem, though sometimes the poem, you know, it can be quite relaxed too. But there's no doubt that Leonard Cohen, you know, is one of those writers who put a lot of effort into writing what seems to be kind of throwaway, and in some ways, all the work goes into making it sound as if no work went into it, yeah. Which is often what writing is about. And so, Leonard, I did have the pleasure of meeting. I knew him a bit for, I guess, the last 10 years. Of his life, I suppose, and met him quite a few times out in L.A. for the most part. And he was you see recordings of him, and he was a very, as he seems in his public persona, very warm, gentle, extremely smart person, and so it was a privilege to know him.
Okay, let's have a listen to your third choice, and this is live in Dublin. This is Leonard Cohen, and I'm your man.
If you wanna drive or climb inside, or if you wanna take me for a ride, you know you can. I'm your man. But the moon's too bright, the chain's too tight, the beast just won't go to sleep. I've been running through these promises to you that I made and I couldn't keep. Ah, but a man never got a woman back, not by begging on his knee. You, baby, I fall at your feet, and I howl at your beauty like a dog in heat, and I claw at your heart, and I tear at your sheet. I'd say, please, I'm your man.
And of course, the great sense of fun about it all as well, and the sense of the absurd about men and women and everything. Would you tell me about the cheese?
You know, at one point I was with him in L.A. and he was serving in his house, and he was serving cheese, and I happened to ask him about whether or not he knew of Epoisse, the great washed rind cheese.
A magnificent cheese.
Well, it's the emperor of cheeses in some intellections. I mean, it's the kind of cheese, as you know, that has a life of its own, and it could easily walk away on you.
It doesn't have any particular physical form, really, does it? Like, it's just sliding off everywhere.
Yeah, it's fabulous stuff. But anyways, oddly enough, though he's a terrifically sophisticated person, needless to say, he hadn't come across Epoisse. Strange, given his Montreal background. But anyway, so I actually had a couple of little rounds of Epoisse shipped to him. And then after that, he wrote to me. It was really coming towards the end, you know,
yeah.
Actually. And he was saying, something along the lines of, having never heard of Epoisse, now I think about nothing else. Yeah. Something along those lines.
Yeah, and you did write a lovely poem in tribute to him where you referenced the Epoisse love, I know.
I do. I just try to write what would one say, an elegy, I suppose. Unfortunately, one's coming to a point in one's life where there are more and more elegies are necessary, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, your next choice. And this is, modestly, a song you wrote yourself with Warren Zevon. It's called My Ride's Here, but it's sung by Bruce Springsteen here. That must be some kick to have Bruce Springsteen sing your words, is it?
Well, this is a kind of double whammy, I suppose. And I'm not pushing this because I was part of it. I'm pushing it because Warren Zevon, I first listened to probably in about, I think it was 1979, around about then, his album Excitable Boy, which is just one of the greatest albums ever made, I think. And I eventually wrote him a fan letter, as I've written a few people fan letters. Starting off when I was a kid, I wrote a fan letter to Richard Green, who played Robin Hood. If you recall, you may be too young to remember this on ITV. And I wrote asking if he had any spare bows and arrows. No, needed them all to fight the Sheriff of Nottingham. But in any case, Warren Zevon, I wrote to him and said how much. I just sent it through his record company or agent or something. Didn't really expect to hear from him. But anyway, he was coming to New York. He was standing in as a musical director on the David Letterman show for a week. So he called the house. And anyway, I met with him and we were walking around New York. It was just after 9/11. And we were, and along the way, he said to me, "Cat, would you like to try to write a song with me?" And of course, I tried to remain cool, and I was just thrilled. So this is kind of one of the first songs I wrote, which is pretty amazing, given that it was with Warren Zevon. So I find it was like having a masterclass in songwriting. So the only thing he had for it was the title, and it came from a night he was playing somewhere in some small venue, a much smaller venue than he deserved, and he heard an ambulance outside, and he said, "My ride's here." So there were two things he wanted me to do. One was to write a song called McGillicuddy's Reeks, because I'd used that in a poem and he liked that. But the only thing we had here was the title, My Ride's Here.
Okay, this is Warren Zevon, My Ride's Here, sung by Bruce Springsteen.
Ask Shelley and Keats, they were out in the street, and even Lord Byron, he was leaving for Greece. While back at the Hilton, last but not least, Milton was holding his sides. He said, "You bravos, you better be ready to fight, or we'll never get out of East Texas tonight. The trail is long and the river is wide, and my ride's here. My ride's here. My ride's here. My ride's here."
That is the poet Paul Muldoon's fourth choice, and that is Bruce Springsteen singing My Ride's Here, which is a song that Paul Muldoon wrote with Warren Zevon. It must still give you a little thrill every time to hear Bruce Springsteen singing your words, is it?
Possibly. You know, I often think, when you think of that Kavanagh song that was a poem that was sung by Luke Kelly.
Yeah, Raglan Road.
Raglan Road. I mean, it's a thrill.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. And then that kind of led to you a bit more, you know, some guys mess around in boats and some guys mess around in bands, I think. And so you mess around with bands and do more, a bit more lyrics and stuff now, yeah?
I do, and or try to. I'd never put it any more strongly than that, honestly. Because, again, one of the things I know, but the only thing I know is how hard it is to do it, you know? But I do...
Is it harder than a poem?
Much. Much. And that sounds strange. But the thing is, if you think about it, nowadays in particular, most poems are actually... are less concerned about, to use the technical term, the prosody of the line. They're less concerned about what's happening in the line, and more often than not, they're not at all concerned with rhyme. Whereas both those features are to the fore in the song lyric. And it's actually much more difficult to write a song lyric, in my opinion. It's much once you've got, say, the first verse, you pretty much have to stick to that template as you go through the rest of it, you know. And so it's much more difficult, I'd say.
And explain how Rogue Oliphant, the band, which is kind of a collective, explain how it works. Kind of, do you talk along or sing along, or you write stuff together? Or
so I write the lyrics for all the songs that this band does. It's a band of, you know, very distinguished musicians. You know, Warren Zanes, Ray Kubian, Chris Harford, Cacho Reardon, who plays bass with us from formerly of the Pogues, David Mansfield on lead guitar, who was actually with Bob Dylan when he was a child, more or less, on the Rolling Thunder Review.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so it's a fabulous band. And as you know, we'll be coming here in a few weeks for Muldoon's Picnic, which is this variety show that we do, and for which I write the songs, and I do some spoken word, you know, over a musical bed, as it were. So anyway, that's the band.
And then Muldoon's Picnic is kind of it's an old-fashioned barnstorming kind of bunch of crazy hippies and poets are coming to your town to put on a kind of a miscellany, is it?
If that's attractive, yeah, and that's what we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a fabulous lineup. We're in Galway on the 13th of May, Armagh the 15th of May, Wexford the 16th of May, and then in Dunleary on the 17th of May with a fabulous cast.
People like Glenn Hansard, Roddy Doyle, Anne Enright, and loads of others, and dropping in and out on different dates.
That's right. The original Muldoon's Picnic was in its heyday in the, let's say, the 1870s, 80s, 90s in New York. In fact, there was one report that said, if you visit New York without seeing Muldoon's Picnic, it's like visiting New York without seeing Central Park. It was a very popular entertainment. So we tried to do a modern version of it.
Excellent. Your last selection is U2, Zoo Station. So tell me about what U2 means to you.
You know, I've always been a huge fan of U2 from very early on. And I think they continue to do remarkable work. They're one of those bands that have actually tried and I think succeeded to kind of keep true to the moment as their career has gone on. Obviously, they're not necessarily number one on the charts anymore, but they're still doing fabulous work. And I had the privilege of being out in Vegas, as we call it.
Yeah.
To see at the Sphere, to see their presentation of Zoo Station in its entirety.
Before we get to that, what did you think of Vegas?
Vegas, you know, it's a place I visited a couple of times. You know, it's what is it? It's a complete caricature of what we think America might be like. You know, it's what always feels slightly sordid there. One feels as if one hasn't done something slightly questionable, one probably should.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But never mind that. It is this particular venue, the Sphere, Actually, I once had an opera. I wrote an opera that was put on the University of Las Vegas, and I took particular pleasure in telling taxi. They would ask you in a taxi, "What are you doing here?" And I'd say, "Oh well, I'm here for an opera," and of course they'd laugh at you. But in any case,
did they know where the University of Las Vegas was?
On the Strip. But in any case, I mean this show, the Zoo Station, was absolutely brilliant and. The fabulous combination of high art and modern and the freshest technology. It was a real experience.
Yeah. Just before we leave it, what is it, do you think, about you two?
That keeps them good?
Yeah, and that has made them kind of the quintessential expression of Irish rock in a way.
You know, one of the things that's really important about them and about any important artist is that they keep trying to do something new. Myself, I must remake, in Yeats's term.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, of course, the artist is in a sense doomed to repeat themselves. But the impulse must be to do something new. And they've had so many very interesting manifestations and continue to do so. So that's one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan.
Yeah. So it's like you still looking to succeed at get the poem that you can go, okay, I've done it.
You know, I suspect so. They're trying to find the great song.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, look, and they found it. They've come very close a few times down the years. So we'll finish up with you two, Zoo Station. Paul Muldoon, thank you very much. Muldoon's Picnic, as you were saying, comes to Galway, Armagh, Wexford and Dublin from May 13th. And as I was saying, featuring, among others, Glenn Hansard, Roddy Doyle and Enroy, different people on different nights. And it is produced by Poetry Ireland. Paul Muldoon, thank you very much. And here is you two and Zoo Station.
RTE.ie.